Your dad was John McCain.
Yes. My dad was a huge music fan. I'm going to tell you right now, my dad loved Willie Nelson. And people are like, you can't say he liked Willie Nelson because he dodged his taxes, blah, blah, blah. Well, he loved Willie Nelson. He did.
Everybody thinks they can do it. How can I become a professional wrestler? You really can't.
I pulled out the gun and I shot two times.
We have a complicated family. We were all raised to argue with each other with intensity, with passion, but also to love each other.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. Alexander Platt has built a unique career spanning the worlds of symphony, chamber music, and opera as conductor, music director, curator, and host. He's based in Chicago and New York, and he's music director of the La Crosse Symphony, the Waukegan Symphony, and of course, the Wisconsin Philharmonic. He spends his summers as music director of the Maverick Concerts in Woodstock, New York, which is the oldest summer chamber music festival in America. And you are so busy. Maestro, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, and it's always a pleasure to be in one of my favorite cities, Milwaukee. Now, city I've always loved.
This might be a little facetious, but
is there some? Is that true? Can you say a little? I think it's unique. It's either facetious or it's not. But go ahead.
How does one become a maestro? I mean, when you were a little boy, and all the other kids were out, you know, playing baseball or football or pretending they were firefighters, were you pretending to conduct an orchestra?
Well, that was in my later teens. I mean, I did do some sports as a kid. I was an avid tennis player and I was a good soccer player. And then about my middle later teens, suddenly a light switched on and I became addicted to classical music.
Were you a musician when you were young?
I didn't grow up in a musical family. I just grew up in Westport, Connecticut, which is a kind of famous town because the great actors Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward lived there. I grew up in a golden age for that community, that post-war era, when it was just this haven for artists and actors and writers and musicians. And so I didn't grow up in a musical family, but I grew up in a community where culture was everywhere. And so I was an indifferent schoolboy violinist. And then I switched to the viola, which is the alto brother-sister of the violin, because it's the oldest story in the world. Nobody wanted to play the viola. So I was kind of shamed into taking up the viola, switching from the violin to the viola. And then that kind of turned a light on, because suddenly when you play the viola in the string section of an orchestra, you're in the middle of the strings. You're not the violins, you're not the cellos. So you're not the rock stars, you're not the prima donnas, you're the quiet one in the middle listening. You almost never get the melody. So you have to spend all of your energy listening. And that's what conductors really have to do. So that was the pathway to being a conductor. And then by my late teens, by the time I was graduating from high school, I wanted to be a conductor.
You went to Yale.
I went to Yale. Yep. Rhymes with jail. Yeah. But, a college in New Haven.
But were you studying music or music theory when you were there?
That's another amazing question. I'm very impressed. I got a college degree in music, but not a conservatory degree. So,
What's the difference?
Well, to be serious, Yale has, their school of music is purely a postgraduate school. So if you go to Yale as an undergraduate, you get a humanities degree in music. So I, therefore, like minutes after I got there as a freshman, just did what I've been doing my whole career. I just kind of started my own orchestra. I put up my own shingle and I kind of revived what was a moribund college music society. And I just got it going. And I remember standing on a dining room table in my residential college saying, "Hey, everyone, we're doing Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik tonight. So I really want you to show up." And that was the beginning. And by the time I was a sophomore, I was getting paid to run a concert series, and that was 40 years ago.
Was that a chamber?
Yeah, it was a chamber. Yeah, it was a chamber orchestra, and I did what every aspiring conductor does. A lot of conductors, there are many paths to being a conductor. Some people are kind of prodigy violinists or pianists. You know, they win a competition when they're 12 or something, and then they become illustrious pianists and then switch to conducting. There's also a great tradition of great violinists becoming conductors. And then there's a great tradition of people like me, the entrepreneurs, who just start their own band. And so that's what I did. And then from Yale, I got to Cambridge, England, and then did the same thing. And then I eventually ended up in a place called Minnesota.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He said, "Oh, do you
Do you sometimes experience telepathy? Do you know what the other is thinking at certain moments?
Maestro Alexander Platt talks about the night he had dinner with the Queen's sister.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Maestro Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic. That's a jump from being
in England to Minnesota. Yeah, King's College, Cambridge, with the legendary chapel and the choir in which I sang as a deputy. That experience where you just feel very spoiled. I worked very hard to get there. I got what's called a Marshall Scholarship. I wouldn't have been able to go if I hadn't gotten a scholarship. So I won that. So I got, as I call it, the three-year lunch. It was this incredibly privileged atmosphere. I'll never forget. I sat next to Princess Margaret at a dinner party.
What was she like?
Very interesting, very attractive, very taciturn. They always get briefed on who they're dining with or who they're meeting. And she had learned that I was a twin, which in those days was more rare than it is now. And she asked me about, do you have a twin brother? I said, oh, yes, I do, Your Royal Highness. And she said, do you sometimes experience telepathy? Do you know what the other is thinking at certain moments? I said, well, Your Royal Highness, I generally know, but there have been a couple of moments where I knew my brother was in trouble and I actually was right. But other than that, no, I don't experience that at all. To which she said, which I shall never forget, quote, well, that's very interesting because my sister and I have that all the time. Oh, your sister. Yes, that one. Yes.
Your sister, I'll the queen. Forget.
Yes. Yes, my sister and I. So I was just in the lap of privilege. And then I went to the character building Middle West, and I got another fellowship to be the guinea pig in what was called the sadly short-lived conductor apprenticeship project, which was started by a conductor whom I had known when I was at Yale. He was the music director of the New Haven Symphony at that time. His name is Murray Sidlin, and he was also the director of conducting studies at the Aspen School out in Colorado, the legendary Aspen School. And I'll never forget talking on the telephone, an overseas call when I was at Cambridge. He was like, come on, get back over. What are you doing out there? Get over back to the States. I'm starting this program in the Twin Cities, and you've got to be my first apprentice conductor. So it was this beautiful moment. You know, we talk about these golden ages, and this was really part of the cultural golden age of the Twin Cities. And I was the roving dollar-a-year assistant conductor, apprentice conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra and the Minnesota Opera. And I had incredible experiences there. And it was a really rough road for me, but not because it was their fault.
You said it's a rough road.
Well, yeah, because I was just privileged by then. I thought I had this right to be a world-famous conductor, and I had no idea what I was doing.
Did you feel like you were going to the boondocks?
No, not the boondocks. No. I had read up on the great traditions in Minneapolis and St. Paul and Milwaukee, and I knew all about this. I've always been an upper Midwesterner ever since I was a kid, because the other thing I wanted to be was an architect. There were three things I wanted to be. I either wanted to be a conductor, or I wanted to be an architect, or I wanted to be a priest. So music won out. But I was infatuated with Frank Lloyd Wright, that great son of Wisconsin, and would look at his drawings for his buildings, and I was fascinated by that. So I feel like I was always meant to be here in this upper Middle West. So then I had a very swelled head. Who wouldn't if you'd supped with Princess Margaret? I ask you. Be fair. So I arrived with a very swelled head, and Minnesota kicked the you-know-what out of me. It really did.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I do this to challenge them and challenge myself, and the result, it's just electric. We have three sessions together, and it's incredible.
Maestro Alexander Platt says every orchestra is different.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Maestro Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic. I find it interesting, though. Your three choices in life were music, right, architecture, and priest.
Yeah, I should say minister, because I mean the Episcopal Church, where they call them priests, but they're not like Catholic priests.
Why did you move away from those two choices and into music? What was the draw?
Music was the thing I for me, the moment was between my sophomore and junior years at Yale, and I went to my first summer conducting school, which is a little school in Maine called the Pierre Monteux School. It was a great French conductor who came to America in the 30s, and he started his own summer conducting course, and it goes on today. And part of the course was that you had to also play in the school orchestra. You couldn't just be a young wannabe conductor and pontificate. You had to be in the orchestra. As you know, I played the viola. So there was this moment, some other conductor was conducting this. It's a beautiful symphony from the early Romantic era, a great German composer named Robert Schumann. And there's a symphony of his, the third of his symphonies, called the Rhenish Symphony. It's about his impressions in the Rhine Valley. And there's this second movement, and in the middle of the second movement, there's like this chorale where the violas lead, this kind of almost religious sounding chorale. And I was so emotionally taken by the music that I couldn't hold the instrument. It was literally shaking off my shoulder because I was so moved by it. And then I realized this is a physical feeling for me, and this is what I have to do. It was literally like, you know, how people in religion have these religious experiences where you, that's what it was for me. And I realized this is my whole life. And so it is a calling in that sense. It is a priestly thing. It's my whole life. That was the moment I knew.
Does it take a certain personality trait to become a conductor?
Well, no. I mean, I think there are all kinds of conductors. There are conductors who are very quiet and patient and intellectual. And there are conductors like me who are, and this is why, I mean, I'm a snob, but I'm not a snob, because for me, it's just a completely visceral, physical thing. I have to get up every day and communicate music. It's a physical thing. It's no different from being a great athlete here in Milwaukee and someone asks him or her, well, how do you do this? And it's like, well, I just do this. This is, I mean, they think about it. I'm not saying they don't analyze and practice. I'm just saying, but ultimately, it's no different from being an athlete. For me, it's just a purely physical thing. And I mean, if some people think I'm erudite in some ways, that's fine. I don't, but I can assure you, it is not an intellectual thing for me. It is a purely visceral act.
So, as you approach different orchestras, do they all have a different personality, or how do you approach it, especially when you walk into a studio or a concert hall with a new group of men and women who are playing instruments?
Well, I mean, I've settled down into having three beautiful orchestras, and they're absolutely unique. They're very different from each other. In Waukegan, I have what is truly a community orchestra of volunteers. And we rehearse like one night a week for 6 weeks. And I tell them that I'm not there doing them a favor. I learn as much as they do, because it's always reminding me how to rehearse. I have a lot of time to take things apart and put them back together. And it's also like I'm getting a conducting lesson every week, because I'm always thinking subconsciously, what can I do to make it better? How can I be clearer? How can I communicate more? How can I fix things? So it really is like I'm getting paid to give myself a conducting lesson. So that's very methodical. And then in lovely La Crosse, at the opposite end of our beautiful state of Wisconsin, that's an orchestra that does three rehearsals spaced out over a week. And so there you arrive kind of halfway up the mountain, and then you spend 3 or 4 days ascending the mountain, and the performance is glorious. And here, with the Wisconsin Philharmonic, which, as you know, used to be called the Waukesha Symphony, but we changed the name because the orchestra plays at such an incredibly high level. The musicians of the Wisconsin Philharmonic are absolutely part of this Milwaukee, Chicago, professional freelance culture. And these musicians, these greater Milwaukee musicians, they have this incredible work ethic, and they show up knowing their music. It's like you're in a rehearsal hall in Chicago or New York. No one knows everything the first rehearsal, but they know like 90% of what they're doing. And so we will do these incredibly challenging programs on all of two rehearsals. The New York Philharmonic would get more rehearsal time, but I do this to challenge them and challenge myself. And the result, it's just electric. We have three sessions together, and it's incredible. And that's my privilege now, to work with the musicians of the Wisconsin Philharmonic.
How do you select the compositions you're going to perform?
The Wisconsin Philharmonic is based in Waukesha County, which is kind of an old school place. And I work with an artistic advisory committee, and they're wonderful people. But at the end of the day, I'm allowed to be something of a benevolent dictator. And I just wanted to do the Aaron Copland Third Symphony because This year, 2025, is the 250th birthday of our armed forces, and I wanted to do something that was very solemn and elegant and above politics and just do this. And it turned out it was the eve of the anniversary of the D-Day landings, and it was, you know, perfect timing. And so many people came up to me in the orchestra and said, it's such a thrill to play this piece. Because everyone plays the Fanfare for the Common Man, but this Third Symphony, Copland, he's like our Beethoven, you know. He really is that great when he's at his best, and he spun a whole symphony out of that Fanfare for the Common Man. And I get to be Father Alex. I really do. I finally realized my other dream.
What's the responsibility of a conductor when you approach these compositions, mm-hmm. and it's written in a certain way, obviously, mm-hmm. by the composer? Do you do an interpretive performance, or do you stick directly to what was written, the score as it was written by the composer?
With a work like, for example, the Aaron Copland Third Symphony, 1945-46, a modern masterpiece, I feel the conductor's role is simply to replicate what the composer leaves on the score as much as possible. Because by that point, composers were very precise about what they wanted. The markings are very, what the tempos are, how you get from one tempo, one speed to the next, how the notes should be shaped, the dynamics, very specific. And also with that work in particular, there's a very famous recording done by another one of the great, great names of American music, Aaron Copland's dear friend, Leonard Bernstein. And that recording is based on a series of concerts he gave with the New York Philharmonic in 1986, and I was there as an undergraduate from Yale. I took the train, many people do, every day. I took the train into New York, and I went to one of those concerts, and so I was there. So as I said to the orchestra, my only job as I see it is to replicate that as best I can, because it's the best, and who am I to think I know better than Leonard Bernstein how to interpret the Copland Third Symphony? So it was a thrilling performance, and in some way it was original. I mean, it was mine, I mean, my interpretation, but ultimately not. It was just an act of homage to Aaron Copland, and to do everything I could to make the score come to life. But from music of the 19th century, 18th century, 17th century, there's almost nothing on the page aside from the notes, and that's where you have to be truly an interpreter. So when I'm working with a work from the 19th century, there's so much the conductor has to do to shape it. But whatever it is, whether it's something written in 1946 or 2006 or 1706, at the end of the day, when you're the conductor, it's all your fault. And if it's a great success, you can pat yourself on the back. And if it's not, it's because you screwed up. You dropped the ball. That's the challenge for a conductor.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
He had the greatest advice. He just said, if you ever feel like you're getting lost, just stop and listen to the orchestra and they'll get you back on.
Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic says, even maestros make mistakes.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Maestro Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic. Well, obviously, the musicians are watching you during the performance. They know what they're supposed to do. But they're watching whatever cues you're giving them. Do you ever make a mistake?
Oh, sure, I make a
mistake. In a performance?
It was like in the Copland Third, there was one mistake. I made one mistake.
What did you do?
Oh, it was just something where I cued someone and they missed it, and then I missed the fact that they missed it. But it's funny, between Cambridge and Minnesota, I finally realized my dream of being a conducting fellow at Tanglewood. And that was, those days, a great, great honor. And I'll never forget the great conductor, Andre Previn. He was visiting the conducting class, and he had the greatest advice. He just said, if you ever feel like you're getting lost, just stop and listen to the orchestra, and they'll get you back on. And that was this moment for like 1 second, I was like, oh, and then I got back on. That was my one little mistake. Otherwise, I would think I was brilliant, if I must say so.
Wait.
I was absolutely brilliant. But that is the work ethic that we have built together at the Philharmonic, that they are so good and their work ethic is so great. And my work ethic ain't bad either. And it's just, we come together and this magic happens. Someone said to me, who plays in one of the major orchestras in Madison, I won't name it, but he said to me recently, he also plays for me at the Philharmonic. He said, Alexander, we wouldn't dare do what you do on two rehearsals. We wouldn't dare. That's, for me, that's the greatest compliment I could get. You know?
Well, there's certainly a camaraderie among
an orchestra and their maestro. When you have a guest performer come in, that's got to be challenging sometimes. I mean, how do you work with them to make sure that their choices, because I'm sure that they come with something that they want to perform. Right. How do you approach it if you don't necessarily agree with what they want to do?
Well, ultimately, you have to serve the soloist, even if you don't agree with, you know, even if someone's taking a tempo that's too fast. I mean, if it's insanely fast or ridiculously slow, then you can say, look, this isn't going to work. But in general, you have to serve the soloist. I mean, if someone can get up on stage and play some great concerto from memory, who am I to tell them, no, no, not that, no. No, you're there to serve the soloist.
So you work around them?
Well, yeah, I work for them, really. I mean, I'm trying to, what can I do that will best serve the music? And in that moment, that's to trust the soloist that they know what they're doing. Every so often, you get someone who doesn't live up to their billing, but that hasn't happened to me for quite some time.
Who's your favorite soloist you performed with?
Wow. Well, that would be someone I actually performed with her here in Waukesha, and I've performed with her in La Crosse. There's an amazing violinist based in Chicago. She's Chicago's own, born and raised in Chicago. This amazing violinist, her name is Rachel Barton Pine.
Who was in that terrible accident.
Had a terrible accident. We won't go into the details. It involved an L train in Chicago. This woman is truly a force of nature. Rachel is a force of nature. And I was very fortunate. I was given the opportunity to be the conductor on a recording she made in Scotland with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra in Edinburgh of one of the great pearls of the repertoire, the Scottish Fantasy for Violin and Orchestra by Max Bruch, great German composer of the 19th century. People think he's Scottish. He wasn't. He was German. But he wrote this very famous piece based on Scottish folk music for violin and orchestra. And I was chosen to be the conductor of the recording. And truly not a month goes by when someone calls or emails or sees me at a function and says, oh, I just heard on the radio your recording of the Bruch Scottish Fantasy. It's so beautiful. And it is really beautiful. I know it sounds arrogant, but it really is one of the great recordings of that piece. So I owe that to Rachel because she had never worked with me. And so she took me on. We always make a point of collaborating. And I know she'll come back here. And she was in La Crosse. And she's amazing.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Someone says, well, what brought you here? And they always say the same thing. They say the energy. They always say the energy. So I must be doing something right.
Maestro Alexander Platt describes how audiences have changed.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Maestro Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic. I'm your host, Libby Collins. What about audiences? You've obviously been in the music business for a very long time. How have they changed?
Well, one has to be honest and say the audiences have gotten older. That is true. However, people live longer. They're more older people than there were. And so I find myself often with full houses, not always, but with often more times than people would admit, with full houses, because we do get younger people and people under 50. And they just, someone says, well, what brought you here? And they always say the same thing. They say the energy. They always say the energy, so I must be doing something right. And then they just say the experience. I can't get this experience anywhere else in life now. And that's true. Classical music, you know, when we were kids, classical music was everywhere. It was in the elevator. It was in the gas station, the bank, you know, it was everywhere. And now it's nowhere unless you go hear it yourself. And so we really are giving them an experience they're not getting anywhere else.
How did COVID affect you? As far as performances, because everything was shut down.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it was really tough for the performing arts. Both orchestras here in Wisconsin, we managed to keep going. We just did what people did. We did performances that we put on our website and transmitted, and we were all spaced, you know, or we wore masks, and we got through it. We got through it.
Were you concerned that it was never going to be the same?
A lot of us were worried. I wasn't. I knew it would go back to the good old days. But some people say that you hear this and you read it like certain arts organizations, quote, never recovered from COVID. In the case of my experience, we've recovered. So I don't know. I can't speak for everyone, but we're definitely back.
Are there pieces that audiences seem to want to hear more frequently than others?
One of the things that truly frustrates me as a conductor is that You see it with the Milwaukee Symphony. Believe me, you see it with the Chicago Symphony. There has been this constricting of the repertoire. It's more than ever orchestras are playing like the same, especially major orchestras. It's one of the reasons why I'm glad I don't work with Milwaukee or Chicago. There's this constant pressure to do like the umpteenth performance of Beethoven 5, you know, Beethoven Symphony number 5 or Tchaikovsky 6 or... you know, Mahler now. You hear Mahler all the time. Gustav Mahler, the great turn of the century Austrian composer. When I was a kid, a performance of a Mahler symphony or a Shostakovich symphony, that was an event. And now it's like all the time. And there's all these other composers, really great composers, who have just, their music has fallen by the wayside because everyone is just scared, so they're just doing the same, like, again, Tchaikovsky 5 again and again and again. And I don't want to be that kind of conductor. I wouldn't want to be a conductor if I had to do the same 35 pieces. And I'm so blessed that in Wisconsin I have two orchestras that allow me to be the artist I always wanted.
What's the difference between composers of, we mentioned, 18th century, 19th century, versus what you've seen in the last 50 years?
I think there's a great decline in originality. And I think that's because there's a decline in tradition, which sounds contradictory, but it's just that there's less and less pressure to know, or at least try to know almost everything about the tradition you're going into. I mean, when I was in school, there was this idea that you had to at least try to know everything or know something about everything and to be grounded in this tradition. And now that's seen as unimportant. And when you don't have that grounding, it's harder to be successful at being original. If you want to really be crazy and original, if you want to be a rebel, you need to know the tradition that you're rebelling against. So I have a hard time finding contemporary composers who are original. But to be fair, it's really hard to be original when you've got now 500 years of tradition weighing on your shoulders. I mean, you know, classical music now goes back 500 years. So there's a lot of music. So how do you do something that's original? So in October, I'm premiering a work by an interesting Wisconsin composer named William Neal. And he's written a beautiful piece called Prairie Music. He spent the better part of a year out in Montana as like a composer in residence in a little colony. He's written this very interesting piece, and it's very traditional, but very modern at the same time. So that attracts me.
How long does it take you to prepare for performance, particularly with something new that you haven't done before?
Well, for example, Aaron Copland Third Symphony, I've conducted that before, so it required a few days to go back and refresh myself with it. But when I first did Copland III, that was a month of my life learning that piece. There are other conductors who can learn a score on their overnight flight to London. I mean, there are people who have photographic memories and literally can like learn the score as they're flying on their in the first class cabin of their transatlantic flight. But I'm not that smart. So,
coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He was a gentleman. He realized he made a fool of himself. But what I really never forget is just being in the room with him and witnessing him rehearse an orchestra.
Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic talks about the time Maestro Leonard Bernstein made a pass.
Now more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Maestro Alexander Platt from the Wisconsin Philharmonic. You had mentioned you had dinner with Princess Margaret. Are there any other notable people with whom you've
met? I only met her once. Don't get it. I'm not saying I was, you know, a guest of, you know, at Sandringham or, you know, anything like that. So,
but who else have you met?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been in the same room as a lot of famous conductors, famous soloists, of course, but I'm just, the great experience for me was being in the same room at the conducting class at Tanglewood as Leonard Bernstein. I'll never forget the moment he walked in. At Tanglewood, there's this very famous house called Saranac up on top of a little hill and overlooking the Berkshires, and that's where they have the conducting classes. And he walked in, and there were two things which always struck everyone when they first met him. They didn't. You never realized how short he was. Like, I am tall. He was like considered. I'm not a tall person, but was tall compared to him. But then the physical electricity that he just that was his physical presence. It was just extraordinary. I can't really describe it in words. The physical feeling that he emanated just being in the room. And it wasn't because he was a star. It wasn't like, oh, Leonard Bernstein. It really was this, again, I'm talking about conductors who have this physical quality. He had that.
He had presence.
He truly had presence. He truly had, you really can't put it in words, except as you did, presence. And Leonard Bernstein, as we all know from the movie Maestro, had a very, very complicated personal life. And I can say now, he made quite a pass at me, and I was at a party after a concert, and I was, I guess, a fairly nubile 19-year-old conducting student, and yeah, it was fine, and that was a different era, a totally different era, the early 1980s from today, completely different, and he was famous, infamous for that kind of thing, but we all forgave him because we loved him because he was a genius. He was a genius like the way Beethoven was a genius. He was really that great. I mean, if American music has a Mozart, someone who could do everything brilliantly, compose, conduct, play the piano, you know, as a virtuoso, it was him. And so I don't feel victimized at all. Not at all. No. He was a gentleman ultimately. He realized he'd made a fool of himself, and so he was a gentleman. And then he asked me some nice questions about. But what I really never forget is just being in the room with him, being as far away as I am from you, just a couple of feet away, and the experience of witnessing him rehearse an orchestra. And it was, I'll never forget, it was with the Tanglewood, the Fellowship Orchestra, the student orchestra. He was preparing a performance of the music of the great French romantic Hector Berlioz, the music he wrote for Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And I will never forget, it was a late August afternoon when there was suddenly a cool breeze going through the trees. And I'll never forget it. It was like it was yesterday. I'll never forget him rehearsing that music the way... Again, the weather, the way everything looked, the room outside, the light, everything, and it's like he had a direct line to the composer. That was it was like a mystical experience. It was like a bewitching experience. That was incredible. And people like that come along once or twice a century. So it was an amazing time.
Being immersed in music as you are. Do you constantly hear it? I mean, is it something that constantly is in your mind?
Constantly in my mind. Yeah. Don't worry, I don't hear voices. Don't get me wrong. But I do hear music. The music is inside of me all the time.
How has that influenced your life?
Well, it's probably made it more difficult because music is my whole life. I mean, I like other things in life, but I mean, it's my whole life. So whenever I'm bored or something, or I'm driving, I'm always just, there's always some piece of music in my mind I can think of. So I guess it's just, yeah, it's a calling in some ways, but I'm very, very blessed and very, very, very fortunate.
Are you thinking of any music right now?
Well, I'm thinking of that beautiful symphony by Schumann I was talking about 10 minutes ago. Yeah, that's kind of running through my mind. It's just there in the back. Don't worry. It's not like I'm not... I'm focusing 99% of my energy on you because you ask such beautiful questions. But no, it's always there. It's always there. I don't know. Does that make me... Maybe I'm meant for the madhouse. I don't know.
What's the future of symphonies like the Wisconsin Philharmonic?
I think symphonies will always prosper if they have leaders who are totally committed and engaged and who are there for their communities, not for themselves. I mean, they're for themselves in that they want to make music because that's their great desire in life, as it is for me, but are there to connect with their communities. And that is in that way, you do have to be a parish priest. And I get so depressed when I see these world-famous conductors who get these big, fancy, you know, very well-paying jobs, and they always say with some interesting accent, I've fallen in love with this community, you know, I can't wait to be part of this beautiful community. And then they just fly in the day before the first rehearsal and leave the morning after the last performance. So I just love being I would never want that life, even if I had it. If I could have it, I wouldn't want that life. Not at all. Not at all. I'm just so happy to be a regionalist. I really am, to be in one place. I just love it.
And we're so happy to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here. I love Wisconsin a lot. Wisconsin is a very special place with a very, very rich history and is still bursting with potential. And I'm just happy to be part of it.
Maestro Alexander
Platt. Don't call me Maestro.
Oh,
that sounds like a Broadway show. Don't call me Maestro. I have the original cast recording from 1956.
Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've been talking with Alexander Platt, the maestro of the Wisconsin Philharmonic. We heard how he became a conductor, some of the people that he ran into along the way, including Princess Margaret and Leonard Bernstein. Now, if you've joined us late and you want to hear the entire conversation with Alexander, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.